The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 181.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is a good buddy of mine, and in my opinion, he is one of the smartest guys out there in the macro space. You all know him well from his YouTube channel, Wall Street for Main Street. His name is Jason Burke. Jason, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you so much, George. I'm really glad to be back. I think it's been about 6 months since I was back, and Bitcoin was, I think, around $9,000 or $10,000. And I remember talking about it with you in June or July, telling people that it was an interesting speculation. I thought it was fairly cheap and it had a good upside. And then we had the Stanley Druckenmiller comments about it, two months ago. And the last 2 months, Bitcoin has just taken off.
Yeah, so tell me about your opinion on that. We go back and forth on Twitter all the time. And as you might recall, maybe, I don't know, what was it, 3 weeks ago or something like that, I started just commenting on not really Bitcoin as far as the price, but the probabilities of Bitcoin becoming the new global money, like taking over all fiat currencies. And my personal opinion was, I think the probability is good that Bitcoin over a long period of time goes to 100,000. I don't know if it happens tomorrow, probably not. Maybe it happens in the next 2 or 3 years, 5 years, something like that. But I think the probability of Bitcoin becoming global money and there being nothing else is probably a little lower than it going to 100,000. And I just presented some of my rationale for that, more specifically because if you've got in something with limited supply, which is obviously one of the main benefits of Bitcoin, scarcity, the market's going to struggle with that because they're always trying to match up the supply of debt with the demand for productive loans. So I've talked to Snyder about that quite extensively, and pretty much everyone that I talk to, whether it's Snyder or Rao Paul, regardless of how bullish or not they are on Bitcoin, they all kind of agree with that. What's your take on that?
Well, first, I think it's ridiculous how the gold community and the Bitcoin community, a lot of people in there, and it's not everyone. I think it's ridiculous how a good amount of people in there just hate each other. Because I think in people's portfolio, I think people should own physical gold, physical silver, selected gold stocks, some silver stocks, and then also a small amount of Bitcoin and maybe some other cryptocurrencies for speculative purposes. Although I don't have a large percentage of my overall net worth in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. I did buy Ethereum at $8 many, many years ago. I don't own Ethereum anymore. I sold it before it went up enormously. I think I got a 10x return on it, but I'm not a tech expert and I'm not a computer programmer. But I think there's an enormous pro-technology bias, George, and you're seeing this with all these technology stocks that are not profitable. And we were talking about this before we started recording with the special purpose acquisition companies. And Jim Chanos has addressed this with total addressable market or TAM stocks and story stocks. And Bitcoin kind of fits in there. So anything, and it's human nature to do this, anything that's already going up starts getting more tension. Then you have bubble vision on CNBC. So I think cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, I think they complement physical gold and silver. So the majority of people's savings for insurance and wealth preservation can be in gold and silver, and then people can speculate on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. I think where people are going to get in trouble is the people who are buying Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies, chasing the price higher and higher and selling all of their gold and silver and all their gold stocks now. And I'm starting to see that online, people lamenting why they ever bought gold and silver, even though there's massive amounts of paper price manipulation right now. And JP Morgan's only getting fined $928 million, and no senior banksters are going to prison for manipulating markets. And I'm using air quotes. And the paper price, despite a weak dollar, The paper price, silver has rallied strongly, but the price of gold up until the last 24 hours, the gold price hasn't done very much, and it's been in a trading range and a correction since the first week of September. And gold stocks have underperformed, the majority of gold stocks have underperformed the gold price and other commodities and other commodity stocks even worse than that.
Yeah, well, I think your point is valid. I totally agree that we're all on the same team here. I mean, we all don't like fiat currency. We see the flaws. I don't know why someone would be super pro gold and not Bitcoin, or vice versa. I just see them as totally different asset classes, and that, or I see them having completely separate purposes in my personal portfolio. Gold for me is just an insurance policy, period, where Bitcoin is a great speculation. And I want to be clear to all the Bitcoin bugs out there. I'm bullish on Bitcoin long term. Short term, I'm a little leery because of the emotion that I see, to say the least. But long term, I'm bullish. I see some potential issues out there with it taking over, with the Bitcoin network, if you will, competing with the dollar and with the digital yuan, and it potentially winning. I definitely think it'll be a long-term store of value, but I just don't know that Bitcoin fixes everything. You see that meme out there. In fact, whenever I post something on Twitter, I'm sure when you do the same thing, you'll get someone in the comments or multiple people saying, oh, Bitcoin fixes that. Well, okay. But I mean, it doesn't cure cancer. It doesn't do all these things. So again, I'm very bullish on the price. I think we need to think through the probabilities a little bit better for Bitcoin becoming global money. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I hope the probability is 100%, because I'm a huge fan from a philosophical standpoint.
Well, governments and central bankers and politicians and bureaucrats, all the things that are involved in the status quo and big government, if Bitcoin threatens the government and the central bank's monopoly on money, you're going to see roles changes. You're going to see potentially windfall profits taxes. You're going to see people that made a lot of money on Bitcoin turned into criminals who aren't criminals. And unfortunately, this is the new normal, the Orwellian. Even this, what we have, George, over the last, since this pandemic started, and governments, all politicians and central planners and bureaucrats at all levels have just taken enormous amounts of power since the pandemic. It's more Orwellian, I think, than George Orwell could have even imagined at this point.
Oh, I totally agree. Let's go back to what you were talking about as far as the risk curve and the Fed, just artificial interest rates, dropping them so low, and or artificially low interest rates, excuse me, and just pushing everyone out to take more and more and more risk. Whether it's a pension fund, whether it's a retail investor. We talked about SPACs, and let's go through that. Explain it for everyone out there that might not have a good understanding as to what they are, and maybe try to parlay that into showing or maybe giving us an example as to how frothy the markets are right now. And what I'm really trying to go over in my own mind is, are we at peak risk curve? Does that make sense? I mean, can the Fed push the retail investor can they push them to take any more risk than they're already doing without just going to a casino or playing the lottery?
Well, it depends how many $2,000 a month universal basic income or MMT checks people are going to get, because the Fed is maybe hoping that people are going to gamble, open up a Robinhood account and gamble on stocks or buy call options on Tesla or buy crypto. So it really depends on how much monopoly money at this point. In general, George, and SPACs, which are special purpose acquisition companies, are also called blank check companies. I really think this is a symptom, and you've been talking about this, and I've been talking about this for a long time too. And if you talk about this on Wall Street, this will get you fired, the Cantillon effect.
Right.
So the special purpose acquisition companies are just another example of the Cantillon effect. And this is where you have the large banks, hedge funds, private equity, large corporations all getting artificially cheap currency and credit. that he is either near zero.
The political insiders and the financial insiders.
Yes, and the lobbyists. So the and you saw this with the pork that was in the new. It's called stimulus. It's really the bailout bill, the new bailout bill that Congress just passed here in the District of Criminals, which I live right outside of. You like that new nickname, the District of Criminals?
I love it.
The largest collection of white collar criminals in the history of mankind, all with multiple degrees and law degrees. So they know how to, if the rules aren't right, they change the rules. They know the legal loopholes. And there was more pork in the new bailout bill than the Wendy's Baconator. Yeah. It was kickbacks to the military industrial complex companies and the consultants and the military subcontractors. So really the special purpose acquisition companies, and we were talking about this before we started recording, Paul Ryan, who's a key political insider, former Speaker of the House, Mitt Romney's former vice presidential candidate, he raised $300 million for a special purpose acquisition company in, what was it, February or March, I believe. So there's an insane amount of SPACs. There are some useful companies that are special purpose acquisition companies. There are some electric vehicle charging stations and some others, but the overwhelming majority of these are rich people that have contacts and access to currency and credit, business contacts. Some of them, George, don't even have a business plan. These are shell companies. There are comments out there from Lloyd Blankfein, who I guess is taking a break from doing God's work. And he actually did an interview on CNBC, I think it was in October. It was about 30 minutes long, where he was actually honest about all this currency and credit sloshing around, all the asset price inflation, all the wealth disparity, how the wealth effect hasn't worked, and in talking about how ridiculous all these extra SPACs are. I think there's a SPAC of a SPAC now. There was a new SPAC ETF that just launched. It's getting ridiculous. I think there's about four new securities and exchange filings for potential SPAC IPOs. And a lot of these companies, George, don't have a business plan. They have assets that they bought cheaply. They've been packaged up together. They're coming up with ridiculous names for these SPACs because I guess they're running out of names. So maybe they'll call one like the Enron SPAC or the Bernie Madoff SPAC. And maybe that will be the peak risk.
Yeah. And to be clear for the people listening or watching who might not have heard of a SPAC, or you probably heard of it, but don't know exactly what it is. I think the blank check company is a great way to describe it. And it's basically you have a shell entity that often has no assets, has no business, has nothing. It's zero except for a guy like Paul Ryan that says, oh, trust me, give me your money. And within the next 2 years, I'll find a business to buy and we'll make a ton of money. We'll give you a great return. And then here's some equity and here's a warrant or two. And the people just give them their money with no cash flow, with no business, with no business plan, with no assets, with nothing, just on a hope and a prayer that this person at the top can find some investment that will make them money or some acquisition target within the next 2 years. But other than that, it's just pixie dust. It's
a story stock. So yeah. That's what Jim Chanos is saying. The goal is to get in early. So if you're a key insider, you get those warrants, you get in early at a cheap valuation. And it's been this way in Silicon Valley with all these unprofitable companies, revenue growth only companies that have no chance of being profitable. Some of these companies, as they scale up, they lose more and more money. Look at Uber and Lyft and all these other, and not Airbnb, the other WeWork, the long list of all these Silicon Valley unicorns now. And a unicorn used to be a $1 billion company. I mean, there's so many of these things with valuations over $1 billion that have no hope of achieving profits 10, 20 years from
now. But at least business. I mean, at least there's like humans and like revenues. Maybe sometimes there's not revenues. I don't know. But at least there's a business though. With these SPACs, there's no business. There's nothing. There's just an idea. It's like Fugazi's. Like,
buy assets cheap. and as Jim Chano says, total addressable market. So they create a story saying they're going to go after this enormous market that's tens of billions per year or hundreds of billions total, or at some point it's going to be that way. But the company doesn't have any type of business plan to achieve profits, free cash flow, you know, the normal things at a normal business, how things used to be. But ultimately, the peak risk, what you're talking about, ultimately the goal is for the insiders to get out and dump this stuff onto retail investors before it crashes. And we've seen this with a lot of IPOs the last few years, how Wall Street has brought so many, and Wall Street's collecting enormous fees for this, bringing these unprofitable companies IPO and then lying about the potential of these companies. These companies, after the lockup period expires, whether it's a Tilray, the marijuana company, and, you know, at a certain price, if the stock is a buck, maybe it's cheaper. But I think Tilray was way, it was an enormously high stock at one point. And I spent a couple years ago going through their prospectuses and their SEC filings, annual report, and their other SEC filings. And there was admissions in there by the lawyers and the executives that the company might never be profitable, and the company was losing even more money. So the more the company scaled, the more money it lost. Mm-hmm. And yet the story was being sold about the total addressable market for legalized marijuana, and the shares crashed. So you're seeing this repeat over and over, and the retail investor is just falling for it hook, line, and sinker, unfortunately, more often than not.
And it all goes back to the Fed. And the reason I say that, Jason, is just for the average listener out there or viewer, in my opinion, and I'd love to get your feedback on this, if interest rates were still at, let's say, 5%, Fed funds, 5% or 6%, which is, by the way, historic norm, would any of this be happening?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Ponzi scheme, and George, this whole thing, this whole system that we have now, and we're at over 270 trillion debt globally. If you add it up at all levels of society, the majority of the debt's government debt and corporate debt. This is a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
Okay. Because, right. And people ask me, why is this a Ponzi scheme? And I love the Kyle Bass quote, "A rolling loan gathers no loss." Now, Kyle says that's for the Chinese banking system and Chinese corporate debt, but now it's for everything.
Yeah, so the entire global economy.
It's the entire global economy. There's an enormous bond bubble. I could give you countless examples of this asset price inflation, distortions with the Cantillon effect, and the bond bubble of these central banks subsidizing big government, subsidizing this bond selling scheme that these large banks have, this bond trading scheme that leverage hedge fund traders and other financial professionals do. And so corporations can sell artificially cheap debt with the help of credit ratings agencies that won't downgrade them. And the reason this is a Ponzi scheme, in my opinion, is because newer and larger amounts of debt is issued to roll over existing amounts of debt that cannot be ever be mathematically paid off. So that is the problem. The problem,
or even serviced at a normal interest rate.
Exactly. Well, even at zero, even at 1% or zero, the debt can't be serviced. Look at Japan. Japan cannot even have a 1% rise in interest rates. They're bankrupt if that happens.
Mm.
So the problem is cash flow. All this debt, George, has been used unbelievably unproductively. So if the debt was for infrastructure or new products and services, that would increase cash flow. New products and services for a company, that would increase cash flow. That could be used to service debt, pay off debt, and that is not happening.
Right.
So that is the problem. The problem is you cannot grow debt without cash flow, because normally you're a real estate investor, you know this, and we're friends with, me and you are both good friends with Jason Hartman.
Yeah.
And how real estate investors use cash flow is you take out a mortgage on a rental property and then use the cash flow and you pay back your mortgage and then you repeat it like in the game of Monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the some of your recent videos. First, I'd like to have you go over what you're seeing in the world in regards to stagflate, tax, and lie. And that's just such an awesome, awesome phrase that you came up with probably, what, 9 months ago? And it's so applicable. And then go into the ECB, this bond bubble, and the currency wars and the dollar tug of war.
Okay, so Stagflate Tax Lie, my position is that if you believe government economic data, whether that's the U.S. government, the Chinese government, the European Union, you still, if you believe that it is 100% accurate, you pretty much believe at this point in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy. So in terms of GDP, in terms of unemployment numbers, in terms of inflation, at this point, it's just about putting out numbers, and they're just going to say whatever they have to say. So the governments can keep borrowing, they can keep the size of government maintained, they can keep the asset prices, whether that's stocks or bonds, propped up, real estate prices propped up. And the real inflation rate in the real economy is closer to the Chapwood Inflation Index, which you have covered. I saw that in a recent video.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, by the way. You're the one that turned me onto that.
Well, here on Main Street, we're just getting killed with shrinkflation. I just went to Target in the last couple of weeks, and it was $150, and not even half my shopping cart was full. I go to a normal, regular grocery store, not Whole Paycheck, Whole Foods, or any of those, and I buy a handful of things, and it's like $50 or $60.
Yeah. Anecdotally, my health insurance went up by like $150 a month. I mean, it's up by like whatever, 20% or something like that. And I don't spend much time in the United States, but I went to Chick-fil-A the other day, which I haven't been to in years, but I went there just to get like a grilled chicken sandwich and just a little cup of yogurt. And it was almost like $14 and I'm like, what is going on here? I look at my receipt. I thought they overcharged me. And the little cup of yogurt was like $5.50. And I'm like, what is going on here? So anyway, keep going. But that was my anecdotal story there at Chick-fil-A and my health insurance.
Well, the other part of this story is shrinkflation. And that's a term that Dr. Pippa Malmgren coined. And that's where either a restaurant or the grocery store or a food company that packages or processes food, they keep the price relatively the same. So the price may stay the same, or the price may only go up a little bit. But what is really happening is the portion size of the amount of food you get. So if it's a box of cereal, there's enormous amounts of air in the plastic bag that the cereal is in. So it's, you have to check the weight or the cost per unit. It's like this with potato chips and many other goods. Also, I don't eat this anymore. Canned soup, Campbell's soup used to put in their old, many, many years ago in their cans of soup, they used to put in a lot of chunks of chicken and chunks of meat and beef, and those are gone. There's like one piece of chicken in some of these cans of soup. And I've seen people just post this all. You're finally starting to see news agencies in Australia and Canada and elsewhere start to kind of cover shrinkflation. And that's definitely not being covered in the consumer price index, unfortunately. And just anecdotally, again, from having discussions with people in the restaurant industry, from contacts and at grocery stores, and also people who listen to my podcast who are work for food packaging and processing companies, they're telling me, and this is, again, not being covered in the consumer price index, that the grocery stores are going to them, telling them that you can't raise prices and you have to change the packaging size. You have to reduce it a lot, because if they raise the price too much, the sales of those items at the grocery store is going to collapse. And then that's going to hurt the grocery store's profits. So what the way they get around this, and more people are starting to wake up to this, thankfully, although hopefully they don't blame capitalism, because if the companies don't figure out how to protect their profit margins, they're going to go bankrupt too. Especially with rising costs and currencies being devalued and all these other countries just trying to devalue their currencies against the dollar. There was actually the Reserve Bank of India, which was India's central bank. There was a Reuters article that came out, and I covered this on my YouTube channel in the last month or two, where leaked information came out from an employee at the Reserve Bank of India that they were intentionally creating enormous amounts of their own currency to buy dollars and to buy their own government bonds to devalue their currency, to boost exports, and then also that was allowing them to run enormous trade surpluses. So this is like the currency wars that Jim Rickards was talking about in his 2010 book. We're seeing it play out now. And all these devalued currencies, and the dollar is weak, but all these other currencies are, some of these countries have tried to prop up the dollar, is going into supply chains, and it's leaking in there, and it's not being properly accounted for by government economic data.
Go over the ECB's balance sheet, because that video that you just did on that in the European bond bubble, that was staggering.
Yeah, so the ECB's balance sheet, and this was before the new bond buying program, is over 60% of their GDP. And they just announced a new bond buying program. And they're subsidizing, in my opinion, they're subsidizing big government. So all these European economies, European countries, they're subsidizing so they can get artificially cheap debt. There is no way some of these countries like Greece and Portugal should be able to borrow so cheaply. And yet that is exactly what is happening. I've been talking about for months, and I think some of your other guests like Van Meter and others would disagree with me, but there is an enormous plan for a while now from the central banks and big government for a bond scheme and asset price inflation to subsidize and prop up the price of bonds. And Wall Street, the large banks, whether that's large banks in the US or large banks in Europe, make enormous profits selling corporate debt, selling, taking their fees as primary dealers on government bonds. So they make money selling bonds that should not be sold at low yields. The bond traders are gambling that the central banks, like the European Central Bank, will buy these bonds at 100 cents on the dollar or overpay. So what these professional investors are doing is they're leveraging up on their bond trades and they're making money from that. So they're making money off the Cantillon effect, off currency and credit being created to prop up bonds. So the central banks are subsidizing bonds. So the part of the bond scheme is for selling massive amounts of corporate debt and government debt that should not be sold at these low interest rates. And then the traders are all doing leveraged trades. These professional traders are leveraged trades on these bonds, a lot of them anyway. And then the central banks then subsidize things further. And if there's a problem like what we saw in February and March or what the European Central Bank is doing, then they just go and buy the bonds.
The central bank just monetizes or just buys the bonds directly or indirectly through the primary dealer banks. And I think a lot of people get hung up on this because they say, why on earth would someone buy a bond that was yielding less than zero, or a bond that was yielding zero, or a bond that is, you know, 10 basis points? When you've got that for 10 or 20 or 30 years, and you're guaranteed to lose money against inflation, or you're guaranteed just to lose money in the sense that it's yielding a negative rate. But what they're not understanding is the people who are buying these bonds, the speculators, they're not buying for yield. They're buying for capital appreciation. And it's this upside down world that we live in, where where people are trying to buy equities for yield and they're trying to buy bonds for capital appreciation.
Well, the other part of this story, George, and this is why things broke so bad in February and March, and credit markets froze and the bond market froze, the bid and ask froze. Like literally, I was hearing from contacts who were bond fund managers that there was no bid. Stuff that went no bid in February and March. That's how bad things were. Yep. And this is because of leverage. So not only are they buying bonds for capital gains, but they're leveraging these trades up. So this is where the repo market and the euro dollar come in with all these sophisticated leverage bond trades, whether it's the basis trade or the risk parity trade. And it's all the leverage. George, it is always when things break bad, like they did in 2008, 2009, February and March, there's always a combination of two things. Normally it's too much leverage and then also the derivatives market breaking. And then the Fed has to come in because the Fed is the liquefier in terms of the liquidity dispenser of last resort. Then the Fed has to come in with currency swap lines. Normally it's to the European Central Bank. That's their largest amounts of currency swap lines, but it's also to other other central banks all over the world. And then they give out these enormous loans with for tens of billions, hundreds of billions, sometimes even a trillion if things are that bad. And then they just waive the loan. So I think this is something that a lot of the deflationists and Brent Johnson and others are missing. And I found evidence of this because the Fed was claiming in 2009 and 10 that the currency swap lines went out and they were only temporary and they were paid off and that was it. And then I found in the May 2020 financial stability report, and I've talked about this in a past interview with you as well, I'll just mention it again, that in the footnote that the European Central Bank went to permanent currency swap lines at the Federal Reserve in 2013, which was not supposed to have happened. So you know things were bad. And people keep bringing up, why has the derivatives market not collapsed? And the derivatives market, for those of your listeners who are not aware, is around 1.2 quadrillion in gross notional value. And this is how the banks, all the large banks, whether it's JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, the large European banks, this is how they make the majority of their profits each year. How tens of billions per year in profits. It's insulated from the real economy. This is why the banks can make tens of billions per year in profits and the real economy can implode. It can get worse and worse. And the banks don't have to worry about velocity money or giving out nearly as many loans unless it's a large corporation or they're manipulating a market or they're selling bonds into the real economy is because over the last couple decades, large banks have figured out the wealth effect, asset price inflation, and how to make all this money off the derivatives market.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, and the Fed put being there. So the bottom line is the risk reward for the big banks when the Fed prints up all these, we'll call them bank reserves, and expands the balance sheet of the primary dealer banks, they're incentivized not to lend productively, like we were talking about before, where those loans go to create more stuff, but they're incentivized to lend to financial institutions who create derivatives and just further financialize our economy. And you talked about the Fed there being the firefighter with liquidity, but I want to point out that Jim Grant always says they're not only the firefighter, but they're definitely the arsonist as well. And I want to make sure that that we don't forget that, because it's not just all about banksters. It goes, in my opinion, it almost always goes back to the Fed.
Oh, I 100% agree, because if the Fed wasn't going to bail out these large banks and senior bankers were actually going to do prison time for fraud, creating mortgage-backed securities, trading on inside information, you know, all this, all these, there's tons of laws on the books. Okay, we just don't have rule of law now. That's the problem. Yeah. So we have laws that are selectively enforced. If you're a senior banker or a corporate executive or you're a political insider here in the District of Criminals or you have the right lobbyists, you won't go to prison for felonies now. So that's a problem. There's tons and tons of laws on the books for fraud. You just have selective enforcement or no enforcement at all of felonies laws that are already on the books. That's the problem.
Yeah. So bottom line is moral hazard. So your last video, you talk about the dollar tug of war. And I know that this is something that you've been using as kind of like a theme, like stagflate, tax, and lie. And it definitely makes a lot of sense to me. So can you explain the dollar tug of war and then tell us what's going on with the DXY?
Yeah, so the DXY is very close to falling out of its five-year trading range. Long-term, the trading range is long-term, there's other support levels below the current levels, but the five-year trading range is almost out. It's very close to leaving the five-year trading range. And really the way the financial system is designed, George, is the large banks sell enormous amounts of dollar-denominated debt, especially when the dollar is weak. So right. During the last period when the dollar index was this weak or weaker, there was an enormous amount of dollar-denominated debt taken out. In the 2009 to 2011 period with Ben Bernanke, the dollar index was in the low to mid 70s back then. And the amount of dollar denominated debt over like a 10-year period starting then exploded. It about doubled globally. And then you had, because of that, as Brent Johnson correctly says, when you have that much dollar denominated debt, you have enormous demand for dollars. However, the Fed can get around this. And this is why the derivatives market has not blown up. And why we need more transparency, or, well, actually, we shouldn't have any central banks at all, but that's not going to happen in my lifetime. I wish we had small government and no central banks, but the currency swap lines are given out, and then the loans are given out, and then they're waived. So the Fed has put out countless fires in the derivatives market for European banks, for foreign governments that are gambling in derivatives, because you have central banks like Brazil Central Bank and others doing crazy forward dollar swaps prior to the Bolsonaro election and other shenanigans that have been going on for years. You have the problems with Greece, what, in 2013, and when they almost blew up there with their problems, and all the European banks that were holding MF, and then the MF Global problems. We don't know, because there is no transparency, how much the Fed had to go in and issue bailouts and do all these things. And the dollar tug of war, what you have is the people here in DC and the New York Fed, they wanted a weaker dollar. And we almost had an enormous dollar rally. We almost had Brent Johnson's scenario play out perfectly in February and March. And actually, he would have been right, except as usual here, unfortunately, and this is a theme of stagflation tax lie, part of the lie component, the government and the central banks and the Treasury Department changed the rules. So right. You saw all these press releases, and you've covered this, George. They actually didn't buy a lot of stuff. So they just issued press releases to manipulate markets, saying they were going to buy these things, and they ended up not actually having to buy a lot of these things. They restarted credit markets. Wall Street started selling enormous amounts more leveraged loans, collateralized loan obligations, selling more bonds. Now that the dollar is weaker again, George, you have an explosion again for the last 8 months of dollar denominated debt in China and elsewhere on this weak dollar that started in May when the dollar started to slide. So you have people gambling on a weak dollar again. And this is why it's in a trading range for now. But the reason the dollar is going to ultimately get weaker is because foreigners are not going to subsidize the budget deficits. The right. Budget deficits, in my opinion, George, are too big. So
meaning the Fed has to buy all that by creating additional bank reserves, which if the government is spending those checks or using those bank reserves to back up the stimulus checks, then it's going to find its way into the real economy.
Well, I was listening to the interview with Stephanie Pomboy. Well, it was their show, Stephanie Pomboy and Grant Williams, the latest one. And she was going through all the different data points and couldn't understand why the dollar index was so weak. I think she was overthinking it. I just think it's supply and demand. And because of the budget deficits, there is way too much treasury supply relative to global demand. And that's because you have the Chinese government and many of these other countries that in the past were running enormous trade surpluses when the global economy was doing better. They were recycling those trade surpluses back into treasuries. And that's not happening.
Right.
Instead, China's stockpiling massive amounts of commodities, all different types of commodities, industrial metals, energy, agriculture, across the board.
Do you think the lack of demand for treasuries is the reason we have seen the Fed's balance sheet go parabolic, while at the same time we've seen M2 go parabolic and almost in lockstep? And just for those who aren't familiar with those charts, that's rare. We've seen the Fed's balance sheet go up, go down, And it there's not a direct correlation to M2, at least the way it's measured. But recently in 2020, we've seen, or it kind of looks like a correlation as the Fed's balance sheet goes straight up and M2 has done the same thing. Do you think the reason we're seeing that is because the Fed is pretty much buying all of the treasuries?
I don't think that the Fed's balance sheet has gone parabolic yet. Let's talk after the Fed's balance sheet doubles from here in under 5 years. So at the current pace, George, unless something drastically changes, so either the size of the U.S. federal government budget deficits drastically decrease, or the demand, the net demand for treasuries from China and other foreign governments drastically increases, or maybe the U.S. federal government changes the rules, again, part of stagflation tax lie, and forces people in their retirement accounts, Americans here, to hold U.S. treasuries,
which
would create more demand, and then they could inflate them away, kind of like how the U.S. government was, during the wars, was selling war bonds, and they were trying to get people to buy war bonds. Well, they might force you to. This is the thing with government and having too many lawyers here in D.C. they just change the rules when things don't go right. So I wouldn't say that the Fed's balance sheet has gone parabolic yet. It is up substantially. In terms of a percentage of GDP, it is nowhere near what the European Central Bank's balance sheet is as a percentage of their GDP. So the Fed's balance sheet as of right now, I would say that the current pace of the federal government budget deficits, and George, the Fed's going to have to buy a lot more toxic garbage. There is a ton of bad financial assets. I don't think any of the write-downs, really, there's maybe a small amount of the write-downs for commercial real estate, for these commercial real estate mortgage-backed securities. I could see a scenario, and there's rumors that Wells Fargo, and we talked about this on our last interview 6 months ago, I think, where Wells Fargo has potentially $1 trillion in a special purpose vehicle of toxic garbage. I could see the Fed buying all of it at 100 cents on the dollar. And we might not even know unless the Fed issues a press release telling us they bought it. So this is how bad things are. The federal government and what the central banks and Wall Street and the federal government here can get away with. We might see the federal government right now, Uncle Sam, or drunk Uncle Sam, as you call him. They don't have to use generally accepted accounting principles. This is where people don't really understand how large the budget deficits are. So people see the number, right? Over 3 trillion, headed towards a 4 trillion pace.
But people think the debt went up by over 5 trillion, or right around 5 trillion.
Well, that's because if you the U.S. federal government only has to use cash-based accrual accounting. They do not have to account for all this off-balance sheet spending. So they've been cheating for years.
Right.
So the real debt numbers, if you count for unfunded liabilities, the off-balance sheet items, the budget deficits with using GAAP accounting would be much, much larger than the $3.7 trillion?
I'm not sure the exact numbers. I keep saying that it's a $5 trillion deficit, and I know technically it's not, but I'm just going on how much the debt has actually increased this year. So to me, that's a deficit, but I guess according to your drunk, insolvent Uncle Sam's accounting numbers, it's not.
Well, the Fed will subsidize the treasuries, but what really worries me is all the financial assets the Fed's going to have to buy. How much percentage of corporate bonds is the Fed going to have to buy? How much leveraged loans? How many collateralized loan obligations? How many commercial real estate mortgage-backed securities, you know, all this toxic sausage. And then if we do have the predictable bankruptcy wave, now that Christmas is over, of all these other bricks and mortar retailers and restaurants and all these other ones that are getting their butts kicked by Amazon, Walmart, Target, Costco, and the large grocery store chains because the rules are rigged by politicians and bureaucrats for those large companies, is the Fed going to bail them out? Is the Fed then going to get into the Cantillon effect and then do what they did from 2009 to 2012 before you started buying real estate, where hedge funds, private equity, BlackRock were able to borrow almost basically at zero, either at zero or near zero, and buy entire tracts of homes to either rent them out or just wait for the property values to start going back up? And again, that's the Cantillon effect, because the Fed just said, you're a selected partner, you're BlackRock, you're a hedge fund, you're a large hedge fund. Hey, Ray Dalio or whatever other large hedge fund, we like you. You can borrow cheaper or you can at least post collateral. And we're going to allow you, if you wait a couple of years, we're going to inflate these real estate prices back up. And you're going to make enormous billions easy. And that's how the system is inherently unfair.
Yeah. Did I tell you that story about when I was in St. Bart's and I was over at Hugh Hendry's place and I was, you know, he's got a, you know, Hugh, by the way, is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. Just, I'm so grateful to how kind he was. And I consider him a lifelong friend, but, I was over there at one of his dinner parties and a lot of his buddies there, you know, investment bankers and hedge fund guys and whatnot. And I was talking to this guy who I became actually very good friends with. And we were talking about real estate. I said, yeah, I got into real estate back in 2012 when the market was really down. And I bought a few, this was my words, a few homes in the Midwest. He said, oh yeah, I did the exact same thing. I love real estate. I think it's a great asset class. I bought a few homes back in the 2011, 2012 timeframe as well. And, you know, we had a couple beers there just BSing back and forth. And it kind of came up. I'm like, okay, well, you bought a few, quote unquote. How many did you buy? He goes, oh, boy, I think around 4,000.
Oh, my.
And I go, okay, your definition of a few is slightly different than mine.
But a few billion here, a few billion there, soon it'll be real money. I mean, we've gone from the last crisis was hundreds of billions and trillions, and now we're talking about many, many trillions.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing I wanted to ask you, you talk about the Fed coming in and bailing everyone out by buying their debt or whatever it takes, basically. What do you think the catalyst is to that? So I'm trying to kind of take a nuanced approach. Like, would the Fed buy the debt of commercial real estate, let's say mortgage-backed securities, if the stock market was at all-time highs? You see my question? Do you think the stock market would have to be crashing in order for them to do all these other things? Or do you think that it's not just about the stock market, that even if commercial real estate was crashing, since our economy is so predicated upon all asset prices, that they'll come in no matter what? And at what, where do you think the line in the sand is? So if your argument is that the stock market could still be at all-time highs and they'll still bail out XYZ Corporation or mortgage-backed securities in the commercial real estate space, how far do you think it would have to go down in order for the Fed to finally step in? I mean, 10%, 20%, 30%. What do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, everything is so leveraged. So maybe 20 or 30%, the Fed would start to panic. I don't know if they can let everything just collapse 40 or 50%. They haven't really shown the willingness to allow that. I mean, for small businesses on Main Street, you know, the mom and pops, they're going to allow bankruptcy. But for larger entities, they haven't. With the commercial real estate market, though, Jim Chanos has actually talked about this publicly. He said that right now, the large banks and the medium-sized banks are getting away with enormous amounts of new egregious accounting fraud. So yeah. He said that the banks are not writing down off any, they're not taking any loan, they're not massively moving up loan loss reserves, they're not taking enormous write-downs on commercial real estate loans, they're counting loans that haven't been paid in months as good still. So if these large banks and medium-sized banks can still get away with even new levels of accounting fraud, then I don't know how much the Fed has to do yet. See, this is, again, part of stagflation tax lie, right? So in the past, a decade or two ago, more of these companies that were committing these levels of accounting fraud would have risked prison. But nowadays, these companies get away, these publicly traded companies get away with such aggressive accounting, they get a fine maybe. I mean, General Electric was repeatedly fined by the Securities and Exchange Commission for accounting improprieties. It was disclosed in footnotes for over a decade now. And hardly anyone even reads the annual report or cares.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, whenever you talk about accounting, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is WeWork. and just how bananas their accounting was, where they basically just took out all of their expenses and just added it back in as I forgot the term that they used. It was
they made up their own metrics too. They had their own growth. They made their own accounting and growth metrics. They just invented them. because the normal stuff that people look at for businesses to see if the business is healthy made the business look horrible. So they just invented it and they got away with it. Well, for a while anyway. They didn't dump the shares on an IPO.
Well, they should have done a SPAC. They would have done a SPAC and there would no problem. They would have just offloaded all that nonsense onto the retail investor. But yeah, I guess the SoftBank is holding the bag on that one, but we'll see how that pans out. Hey man, I know we're running a little short on time. And so before we go, I wanted to open up a can of worms that I know we could probably talk about for the next 3 hours. And that's the Chinese digital currency, the DCEP, the digital yuan. Have you been giving this much thought? And what, if you have, how do you see this integrating, if at all, with the Belt and Road Initiative, the foreign direct investment with the Chinese in South America, Africa, India, Eastern Europe? And how do you see that maybe playing out in the future? I've been giving this a lot of thought lately.
Well, the Chinese are still addicted to dollars. I just said this earlier in the interview. Now that the dollar was weak, they're back to borrowing record amounts of dollar-denominated debt. So if the dollar has rallied, they're going to have problems too. They're going to drain their trade surpluses and the reserves paying that off. So, and the other thing is the Belt and Road Initiative, George, when they set up these things with foreign governments, they set up dollar-denominated debt and borrowing dollars too. So a lot of these other governments are not taking massive amounts of Chinese yuan or Chinese yuan denominated debt. So it's more complicated than that. So I've seen some of your videos where the amount of the dollar being used for global trade is declining, but it's not declining rapidly.
Right.
So I think with the they're obviously the Davos crowd, the World Economic Forum, they prefer the Chinese model. Okay, so it has control. Large corporations are getting immense amounts of economic dominance now and power that they shouldn't. They're getting their debt subsidized now here in the U.S. and Europe. And they prefer China. They prefer the Chinese model. So they don't like free speech. They don't like a small government. They don't like low taxes. This is, we're going to have to see. No. I have mixed thoughts about what's been going on in China. The Chinese economy is exporting a lot and they are stockpiling commodities, but there's some real weird things going on with their currency. And again, if China's exporting so much and doing so well, George, and yes, they're selling massive amounts of PPE and equipment, that's medical equipment and other things. But what is the US consumer is tapped out. If you look at the data for the US consumer, the savings rate has spiked. So there's not a savings glut like these Keynesians are saying. There's a savings spike for the consumer. A lot of it is from the checks that people got. And then people are paying down credit card debt. And people don't have jobs or they're losing their small business. So I don't see an enormous amount of demand from the US consumer or European consumers for Chinese goods. And there are a lot of people, especially in polling, George, so the I think there's a disparity here between the technocrats, people running these governments, a lot of these governments, and large heads of large corporations and banks who prefer the China model, you know, World Economic Forum, Davos crowd, versus the average person on Main Street here in the US and Europe that is not as favorable to the Chinese government and buying Chinese products now. Because you're starting to see in polling, and I know that China's, you know, they're doing 300 million in transactions for the digital yuan inside China, and they're making these steps and they're doing it incrementally. But what you're also seeing on the other side of this is the polling about how Americans now, 70% of Americans hold a very unfavorable view of the Chinese Communist Party and how they will, if they can, they don't want to buy goods made in China or assembled in China.
So yeah, they still do all their shopping at Walmart, Target, and Home Depot. That's you just that might as well be China Mart. and Target and China Target and China Depot. I mean, every single good in there is from China, almost.
You have a good point, and over time, this is not going to happen right away. So this is over the next 10 or 15 years, and we'll see what happens with the crazy stuff going on in D.C. with Congress and how if the tariffs on China stay or they're dropped. So that could play a part as well.
I think one kind of dimension I wanted to go over there with the PBOC, but it doesn't matter what the PBOC or the Fed or any of these central bank digital currencies. How does this work when we eliminate the middleman, meaning the commercial banks, to where you can go directly to the Fed for lending? You, meaning the average Joe, and maybe small business and mid-sized business and huge corporations, but you're borrowing from an entity that has an infinite balance sheet and has no problem being insolvent and doesn't really have a P&L. I mean, how much of a game changer is that in the long run?
Well, what really worries me is that they're going to see all of our purchases, and then they could just track and tax every single transaction.
Right.
And then they could change the rules ex post facto that, George, you bought something on your credit card or debit card, and we've decided 6 months later after you bought it that now we're going to fine you, or we're going to penalize you on a social credit score, or we're going to put you on a list. Or we're going to make sure that you get fired from your job because you bought this. So that's what worries me, is now the government is getting so intrusive, so invasive. And that's what's happened in China since the social credit score has been implemented. So now, more than the government being able to hand out universal basic income checks, what worries me is that they're going to be able to track and tax every single transaction. And then they could decide arbitrarily subjective, and Congress won't even have a say in this, probably. They'll be able to decide if you're doing something they don't like, they can hurt you really bad financially. I mean, at some point, they may just shut down. Well, I'm here in the U.S. still. You're not here full time. They could just shut down my credit cards or my debit card. They could just shut them all down.
Do you think that they could use your social credit score or the information they're receiving from all of us having an account with the Fed, or all entities having an account with the Fed, to determine your ability to get a mortgage, and if so, your interest rate? Meaning, if you have a better social score, that you have a better chance of getting a mortgage, and if you do get a mortgage, you'd have a lower interest rate. Basically what a credit score would be today.
That is exactly what's been going on in China, George, with the social credit score. So if you say nice things about the government and you're a government employee, you work somewhere in the Chinese Communist Party government at one of the levels, and you're obedient, you do a good job there, you can get cheaper interest rates to borrow to buy a car or buy a house.
Right.
Or start a side business. That is exactly how credit scores and cheaper debt are being used in China already.
So you see that playing out here in the United States?
Possibly. I mean, there's a lot of people starting to wake up now. There's a lot. There's an enormous amount of people now that are, I guess the term is red pill, that's overused. I don't want to get you in trouble. I said the phrase there in the keywords and the algorithms that might get you in trouble, the red pill, even though it's from the Matrix. But there's a bunch of Americans now that are starting to get red pilled, because a lot of them are small business owners, George, and they want to have the chance to survive. They think that they can protect their customers and their employees. And we have these dictators, these totalitarian politicians at all levels and bureaucrats telling them, changing the rules, tens of thousands of dollars spent making their restaurant or shop compliant with all the new rules. And then the rules are changed again.
Right.
So I think there is, at the grassroots level, people are waking up. Is it too late? I don't know.
Only time will tell. All right, buddy. Fantastic conversation, as always. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go? Definitely tell us about your YouTube channel. Tell us about your Twitter. Tell us about your Patreon and anything else that you want people to be a part of.
Sure. One last thing that I forgot to cover. was what I think the West, other Western countries are headed towards with Stagflate Tax Lie. And one of the most perfect examples of this is the stories we've been seeing coming out of the United Kingdom for the last couple of months. And I've been covering this in videos, in a number of different videos on my YouTube channel. So what the United Kingdom has done is, really since the pandemic started, they've paid out 80% of wages with a version of MMT and universal basic income. So this is just currency creation. They're monetizing government debt. Taxes, it looks like taxes, George, are about to be raised across the board, even though the economy is not doing well there. The inflation formula was just changed there again to screw over retired pensioners. And it looks like over £100 billion per year in retirement payments there are going to be, the pensioners are going to be screwed out of that. And they have government reports from their Office of National Statistics about bad shrinkflation in a lot of different products. So food items, consumer staples, whether that substitution of quality of goods, so the size of a candy bar and the quality of cocoa, the amount of cocoa in the candy bar declines drastically. So there's all those different examples, and it's coming to Canada. It's going to be coming to Canada, a lot of Western countries, other European Union countries, Canada, Australia, the U.S., a version of that, it looks like, if the people in power get their way, a similar model to that. And then as that gets implemented, then they can further accelerate the China model. In terms of the rest of my work, they can check out my YouTube channel, which YouTube, unfortunately for now, my live stream shows are blocked. I can't even change any of the stuff on my software on the back end. So YouTube's tech support has been really screwing me over there. I've tried for the last couple months to get them to help, and they just keep giving me ridiculous excuses. But my YouTube channel has a lot of good content. Hopefully in the next couple weeks, I will start interviewing big name guests again. And then I have my Patreon, which is only $5 a month. There's around 150 articles behind the paywall there on a lot of interesting topics. There is an article there for your listeners about that I wrote, I think in June or July, about the commodities ETFs. So Jim Rogers came out with the Rogers Raw Materials ETF, which is, it's not an ETF, it's the Rogers Raw Material Fund, the index. And unfortunately, he doesn't have an exchange traded fund. He has a mutual fund, which is high fee, but there's a number of other mutual funds that have similar balances to his commodities commodities index.
Yeah.
And it tracks similar to that. So if your listeners want to have trades with the weak dollar and they want to protect themselves from higher imports, higher cost imports for Americans, which is going to happen with a weak dollar if this trend continues and the commodities price rally, then that article from June or July will be good. And I also have many, many articles about gold stocks, which are cheap and their balance sheets are superb and they're increasing dividends, and oil stocks.
Yeah, everybody's forgetting about the gold stocks. With Bitcoin taking all the headlines, everyone's forgetting about gold miners. So that could be interesting.
Congratulations on your success. It's really unbelievable what you've accomplished in the last year.
Well, I appreciate it. And everyone, you got to check out Jason's YouTube channel for sure. I just watched his last couple videos in preparation for this interview. And even though he's not doing the live stream stuff, the content is still absolutely fantastic. So check that out. Check out his Patreon page. We'll put a link in the description below. And Jason, I want to thank you for your time. I appreciate all the hard work and the content you produce. I'm a huge fan and can't wait to have another conversation.
Great. And I'm glad that people are promoting small government and Austrian school economics, because the stuff we're getting out of Wall Street and the mainstream financial media is just absolutely horrible.
Couldn't agree more. All right, buddy. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.